Welcome back to the Go-To Food Podcast, brought to you by Deli. Deli is a food platform from the team behind Depop that sell the best independent food and drink products in the world that other shops don't really know about. Head to www.deli.market and discover the thousands of creative products dropping daily and use the code GOTODELI for 25% off everything from us. Today we're joined by a man who was the youngest ever Brit to win two Michelin stars and now has a food empire that runs from Belgravia to Doha to Tokyo and beyond. And talking about Japan, your Michelin star restaurant Muse is hosting a collab on the 10th of July with our previous guest, Joe Laker's favorite chef. Well, you're also one of his favorite chefs, but his other favorite chef, Chef Endo.
Yeah.
What culinary treats does the evening have in store for us?
This idea came up when I did a collaboration in Tokyo with Chef Zoyu from Den. What we did, rather than with a normal collab where someone does three courses, the other does three courses, we kind of then played on each other's own three courses where, for instance, I added some garnish or he added a little bit of something to my sauce or whatever. So it was just a little bit more thought and detail rather than just saying, okay, you're going to do four courses and I'm going to do four courses and there's the collab.
So you still come up with your courses?
Yeah, but then I'm doing, you know, for instance, like we start off with a round of snacks, which comes from us, and then he's doing six different styles of sushi. And on the sushi is where I'm adding something that I've foraged. So whether that's like some pickled cherry blossoms or could be a rose oil or something like that. So there's a little bit of something from me to flavor his sushi and then he's going to let me know what he wants to do to mine. So
Yeah, right. That's great.
So it's a little bit more thought rather than saying, as I said, like
it's a proper collab.
Yeah,
rather
exactly.
Rather than a fake one.
Well, yeah.
There are a lot of fake collabs going on at the moment.
And then the other thing is, you know, the way that the service is run, you know, is very different as well because with his sushi, you know, it's about him doing his thing. The way that we're having it is we've got, you know, six people coming in a block of time. So it'll be like first, second, third, fourth seating. So there's a nice flow. And then he can then spend time with each of the six rather than it being like all at once.
Is it sold out?
Well, it's sold out in about an hour and a half.
Oh, it's annoying, isn't it?
Yeah.
I suppose if you've got...
You want to put on another six at the end or not?
It's a bit difficult.
Okay, fair play. Your normal 10-course menu is all inspired by your memories.
Yes.
My favourite...
I have a lot of memories.
Yeah, when I was looking at the menu... Oh, we're going to bring them up. Don't you worry about that.
Sure
my favourite one is the bitter cold.
Yeah.
Can you talk us through the story behind that? Because it's brilliant.
I can't remember it. Which one was it?
Pierre Coffman.
Ah, yes, the bitter cold. Yeah, oh, Pierre. So basically, so when I was working with him back at Royal Hospital Road, the Le Ton Clair restaurant, which is obviously, you know, the mecca of a lot of talented and amazing chefs throughout spring, summer, autumn, winter, you know, you'd be outside prepping, you know, and in the dark winter cold days of, you know, of November, well, I'd say even September sometimes, September through to February, March, you know, when you're preparing and shucking, you know, scallops or scaling fish or whatever outside, you know, it was
bitter.
Hold on, why are you outside?
Well, because it was a way of, you know, sometimes him punishing you and, you know, get out on the naughty step.
Right.
You know, or it was just a bit easier because you just washed down outside and,
it was easy, rather than
making a mess in the inside kitchen. But, you know, of course he wouldn't let you, you know, wear a coat or anything or gloves or whatever.
Really?
Just like get on with it, yeah.
So what, the bitter cold as a dish, what is...
It was a crossover because, you know, as I keep, you know, interacting all these different stories that I have, I think it was actually a scallop dish because it was, you know, we were constantly preparing the scallops outside and it was a, you know, kind of a pun on a pun, so to speak. As it being in winter, it's probably something with root vegetables or something, celery, I think, or something.
Mentioning the menu, when you opened, you got a lot of abuse. I thought massively unfairly.
Did you know that?
In the press, saying it was, you know, the most pretentious menu in history. By the way, we can swear on this podcast. Let's get angry. But I mean, what were they talking about? And did you feel, because you then did put ingredients listed, whereas I think at first you didn't.
No. I had always, you know, the idea was, you know, there was going to be three main ingredients and then a story. And okay, people didn't like that, but who really cares? You know,
exactly.
At the end of the day, everyone is entitled to an opinion.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, we're a free country. Just about. So I think, you know, the idea for me was being, you know, that little bit more personal.
Mm-hmm.
And if people think it's pretentious, then, you know, they're probably saddos.
Yeah,
anyway.
Do you know who said that?
It was just an article. I think you'd mentioned it before, them just being annoying. But you are looking for a new head chef. If you could pick one in the world right now, this is quickfire. Who are you going for?
Oh, God.
Who's your favourite chef?
Well, listen, if I could have two chefs moulded together, it would probably be Pierre Coffman and Joel Robuchon, you know, married into one.
Really?
Can we get them back into the kitchens? I don't know.
At their peak or now? You'd be shuffling them around.
At their peak, yeah. No, at their peak, yeah. Because it's funny, because like Pierre Coffman, you know, he was, you know, he's very sort of gutsy, hearty soul kind of guy, you know, and that related into his food is very, you know, very a lot of thought into nice, beautiful sauces, and just there wasn't too much sort of, I'd say, frills and spills. It was just right the heart of the flavorsome, tasty dish, you know, with bold flavors and a simplistic approach to that. You know, there wasn't a lot going on the plate. There wasn't too much that was like, you know, tweezered back then, that's for sure. It's like, get on the plate.
Put it on the plate, yeah.
And it didn't really matter where it went, whereas with Joel Robuchon, it was, everything was precision, everything was detailed, and if you didn't have 39 dots, then, you know, it was in the bin. So having the sort of two comparisons for me as a chef was, you know, was very interesting. And again, you know, character-wise, in terms of how they run the kitchen, both very different. Pierre Coffman was very, very vocal, whereas with the Joel Robuchon in service, it was silence.
Really?
Yeah. What was more terrifying though? Because obviously,
I mean, it was. Yeah. It was, you know, because
you've got Pierre screaming at you, and then Joel,
and then it was complete silence. Apart from, you know, he would call on the checks, and that was it. Nothing else. And you know, it made you, you know, train your ears to listen to everything. And because like all the checks, you know, were very detailed, and the menu was, you know, it was a big menu. You had a full a la carte. You had two tasting menus, and then you had specials as well. And I was on the meat, so you know, it was a tough section. So we basically had to write everything down. Literally, we had like a piece of aluminium tinfoil stuck to the table, and then we'd write down everything that came on, the cuisson, and you know, how it was prepared, et cetera, et cetera. And then on top of that, you know, you're doing, you know, cooking and plating, and you know, so it was tough, I would say.
Extraordinary.
I'd read that some chefs couldn't even look him in the eye. You got bollocked if you looked him in the eye during service.
Being the youngest boy, I obviously stood out, you know, a fair bit, and particularly with red hair, because definitely I haven't seen many French people with red hair. He thought that the Brits sort of, you know, kind of liked omelettes and things like this. So when his wife used to come in, you know, he would say, oh, who's going to make my wife, you know, lunch? And all the chefs were like, not me. Ah, l'anglais, you know, they're good at making omelettes. So then I would have to make the omelette for his wife. And the first time I did it, the French are very particular with their omelettes. You know, you can't have any colour. It's got to be, as they say, baveuse, which means kind of, you know, semi-cooked and nice and runny on the inside. So I was like, oh my God, look at me. Anyway, he said, oh, I got a thumbs up.
Oh, really?
It was perfect. Yeah. And from then on, I had to make the omelettes every single time.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So I thought, you know.
What about the working hours there? Apparently they were beyond anything.
Well, yes, they were beyond anything. But as I would say, it's a balance of, you know, sort of, okay, you're in one of the best restaurants in the world, working for the best chef in the world. Okay, the hours, they kind of suck, but, you know, you just did it.
But what were they?
Yeah, what were they? Well, just how, oh, like, how long, no, is it?
I was sleeping 3 hours a night, so I would get up at... I was living in a place called Place de la République, which is near the Gare du Nord, and I'd have to get to Trocadéro on Avenue Poincaré. So it was a good 45-minute, you know, on the metro. So I'd get up at 4:45. I would get there at around, you know, 5:40. We'd meet sort of a few of the chefs and have a, you know, two double espressos at about 5:45. And then we'd be in the kitchen, you know, at 5:50, 6:00. And then we'd work all the way through until 4 p.m., I'd go for a 20-minute break for a big bowl of Haagen-Dazs ice cream to get that sugar load. And then be back, and we would leave at around 1 o'clock in the morning, and then I'd be home at 2:45, be in bed by 2, and get up at 4:45.
Wow. Christ.
Yeah. So you do that 5 days a week, and then you have the weekends off. Friday was even more of a killer, because you would probably get home when you hear the old birds tweeting. It was quite romantic of being in Paris, you know, the birds tweeting, but yeah, not when you've just worked, you know.
Is that because
2 hours?
Drinking after a shift, or is that because you were doing a deep clean?
Just finished deep clean, yeah. I got home, you know, generally on a Friday was like 4:45 in the morning.
Christ.
Yeah, so it's quite hardcore.
That's pretty rock and roll.
But on the upside, you know, as I said, you're working with amazing chefs, you're working with amazing produce, you know, everything was about the team. And I was petrified going there, because I thought, you know, I worked with Pierre at Tom Clare, all the chefs, they hated the Brits, like, completely. They just thought we're the worst of the worst, couldn't cook at all. Roast beef, you know, that was about it, can't cook. So when I went to Paris, I thought, oh my God, they're going to be, like, even worse.
Yeah.
And they weren't. They were super friendly, you know, they made me feel at home. And as I said, it was all about working together as a team and helping each other. So, you know, it kind of made it, you know, that little bit easier. And as I said, like, you know, you really got to understand, like, the benefits of, you know, when chefs really work well together in terms of, you know, the workload that we all had was insane. Every section just had so much to do. So everyone, in a way, did really help each other.
And when you were working with Pierre, I mean, obviously he had some incredible dishes. What was your favorite dish of Pierre's?
Oh, there were many.
Obviously, well, give us a couple.
Well, the pig's trotter, of course, with the, you know, with the mashed potato. He had the scallops with the ink sauce and red pepper and garlic puree. You had the foie gras sauterne with a little rusty potato and the sweet shallots. You had, all these game dishes he used to have, you know, lièvre, hare royale. He used to have, you know, partridge and teal. And, I mean, just like endless mouth-watering stuff. His confit salmon with a piperade, you know, it was just like delicious.
He seems like such a lovely, warm, just like melty man nowadays. Obviously, he wasn't like that back in the day. What was the angriest you ever saw him? Like, is there one day in your memory which still stands out?
You know, all I just remember, you know, he had these big, heavy wooden clogs, and you get occasional, you know, like, you know, kicking the ankle, you know, or a little tap. But it's part and parcel, and, you know, he's just like, he's being himself, and, you know, sometimes he did get upset, but it was what it was, and we just got on with it. But at the end of the day, you know, he was a great teacher, amazing guy to work for, very, very passionate about being a chef, you know, and being in the kitchen with the guys, leading from the front. And, you know, it just shows that, you know, the amount of chefs that work through his kitchens and who he developed and helped to develop is a total, you know, respect to him.
Yeah.
Well, we are sponsored by Deli, who are just the most incredible online food marketplace. And each episode, we play a little game called Deli Steady Cook, where we bring out a mystery bag of their amazing products.
Okie dokie.
And by the way, if you want to get hold of these products, you can use the code GOTODELI with the double L, and you get 25% off. You're welcome. But Tom, Ben is going to present you a little cheeky bag, and you're going to say, at the end of the pod, what you would make with these things.
Alrighty.
So I'm just going to talk you through them.
Okay.
And then you can have a think about it.
All right. How long do I get? 5 seconds?
No, you have
the whole podcast.
So you got about another 40
just
minutes.
At the end.
Okay, cool, yeah. Cool.
Is this the right bag, Tom? Yes, it is. So I've got a couple of like naughty little tinned fishes. There's a tuna and a sardines.
Yeah, tuna, my favourite.
They're beautiful.
My wife is going to be like laughing because she knows that I don't like really sort of oily fish. So.
Oh, really?
Anyway, it's fine.
Well, you can, I mean, one of them you could just give
to her.
You're
taking
it
home for your wife tonight. So
Coconut milk.
This is unbelievable coconut milk.
Okay.
From the Rempapa Spice Co.
Oh, nice.
Sambal Shiok, very nice restaurant. They've got a signature laksa paste.
Lovely.
So you can, I mean, in
some
ways...
There's like a curry coming on at the moment.
Yeah, there's something...
And then the same people that make the coconut milk make this very naughty little turmeric and lemongrass. It's sort of a marinade, it's sort of a curry sauce, curry paste. And then some of the best ramen noodles you can buy. So I'm going to put that back in your bag.
You can just think about that. I feel you're already there, but...
Yeah. No, but you know, you can...
You know, we're not going to push you for an answer right away.
No, it's good.
Tom, you knew you wanted to be a chef from an early age.
Very early,
When I'm reading your menu, I see a lot inspired by your mum when you were out, you know, foraging up in Norwich. Just tell us what are your...
Norfolk. Well, Norwich.
It is.
Oh, no,
so you went to Norwich Cajun College, which we'll come on to, but Norfolk, as in the wider county. When you're in Norfolk, you're probably not going to be rummaging around in sort of Norwich city centre.
Well, yeah, no.
Yeah, you'd be getting different things around there.
Maybe on a late Saturday night when I was a teen,
But just give us a couple of your childhood food memories, because obviously your twin brother, is also a chef as well.
Yes, he is,
But you guys must have been quite competitive. Did you fall in love early?
Yeah, so mother was, as I said, a great home cook. She grew everything in our garden. We had a massive sort of vegetable garden that she, you know, tended to every day. Spring, summer, autumn, winter, something would be growing. So there's always something that needed to be attended to, you know, whether it was picking or sowing or weeding or...
So you were sent out to do that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, child labour and all that, So probably, I remember, you know, it must have been about probably 5, 6, you know, going in there and... just eating things straight off the plants as you do. And then, that sort of went into the kitchen. I remember, you know, digging up first sort of lovely new potatoes, out of the garden, out of the earth, straight into the pot and the pan, and cooking them and eating them in, you know, 30 minutes. And yeah, so we then started, you know, sort of cooking in the kitchen with the mother and helping the family meal, and then doing, you know, sort of sweet stuff and cakes and breads and stuff like that. And then my father, he was in the wine business. So he had an importing, exporting company, as well as a shop in Norwich. So he was doing a lot of traveling through France. So a lot of our, you know, sort of sometimes our Easter holidays, summer holidays, we spent, you know, in France, driving all the way down to the Auvergne, where we kind of went on summer holidays. So we were kind of nipping, you know, two or three different sort of wine regions as well. He'd go and see his suppliers. We'd then come out sometimes for lunch, or we go and brush the cellars out or something, you know, something interesting. So in a way, it was quite evident that we were going to come somehow sort of, you know, be steered into that path.
You sort of had no choice.
Well,
as in not that they were,
it was kind of, you know, our world. And because I would say we were pretty naughty as kids, you know, school was pretty at the back of our heads, you know, in terms of being fulfilled in any way. Just before we left primary school, going into high school, we kind of made the decision at 11 that we were going to be chefs, literally at 11 years old.
Really?
Yeah. And so I had it on my shoulders that I would, at the age of 11, pretending to be a school leaver, you know, at 16, I rang up the local college, Norwich City College, at 11, put on my deep voice, and I said, look, you know, I'm interested in becoming a chef. What qualifications do you need? Do I have to have an interview? What's the process? Da, 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 da. And they were like, no, no, not at all. No, you just come for an interview with one of our head teachers. And yes, there'll be, you know, there'll be an entrance exam, but, you know, it's very, you know, very easy. It's multiple choice. And basically, you know, if we like you, we'll take you. And I was like, so there's no exam. You don't need any results. No, not at all, no. So I then, you know, entered going into high school knowing that I didn't need any qualifications at all whatsoever. So in a way, the next 5 years were a bit of a blur.
You were liberated.
And
I bummed
around, literally. And you know, I put my parents through hell, because you can imagine every parent's teacher's evening, you know, just got worse and worse and worse. Like, what your son's doing, he's a loser, he just messes around, he's a clown. Yeah. Maybe you should go and be employed as a, you know, in the local circus or whatever, because that's, you know, more suited. And so this went on, you know, every year. And then we promised our parents on our last year at school that we'd revise really hard, and, you know, we'd study and da da da. And of course we didn't, you know, we're just in our rooms and listening to music or whatever. And, you know, and anyway, my father, I remember the day, you know, we were standing in the kitchen, and my father is, you know, sort of, well, I think he's thinking that he's going to be a proud father after seeing our results. And of course that wasn't the case. So he's reading the results. And I remember sort of seeing his face going from kind of like quite chipper to then like bloody furious. Oh, and he turned to me and my brother and he goes, I just can't believe these results. You know, what the F you gonna do? You know, he was literally like, you know, fuming. His face had turned red. And then I just thought, okay, I better tell him the truth now. So I said, we're gonna become chefs. And he looked at us like, what the, you know, what do you mean you're gonna become chefs? I'm like, why? And then I explained the whole story. I said, well, just think about, you know, with mother growing up the garden, cooking, and, you know, going tendering vegetables and all this, going to France and trying restaurants and suppliers, blah, blah, blah. And then I could see him like, well, how, you know, how's this gonna happen? You got no result. Like, what are you gonna do? And I thought, okay, I better own up even more. So I said, well, as it happens, you know, when I was 11, I called them up and they told me that I didn't need any qualifications. So at that point, he didn't know whether to laugh or cry or whatever. Anyway, he then said, well, there's no other choice. You know, off you go.
That's all you've got, yeah.
So that's what we did. Yeah. So then we went to college and, you know, we were then, went from sort of, I guess, sort of D-class students to A.
We were quite a turnaround at that point.
Yeah,
and then post-catering college, you start applying for jobs, and you're struggling to get in the door. So what do you have to do to get in with the wonderful, or should I say terrifying, David Cavalier?
Well, the funny thing was, again, you know, it's a conundrum of when you leave, you know, your study place, college or whatever, higher education, university, you kind of have to figure out what the hell are you going to do. Me being, you know, a very go-lucky kind of student, you know, that excelled and, you know, was very passionate and hardworking and whatever, I said to my father, you know, I've got to go to London. That's where, you know, everyone is. You had, yeah, this is, I'm talking, you know, 1990s. So, you know, you had the Roux brothers, you had Marco, you had Pierre Kaufman, you had Nicolas Dennis, Raymond Blanc, you know, just all these guys, you know, were at the sort of coming into the pinnacle of their careers. And I said, you know, I've got to go to London. That's where it's happening. So I said to him, you know, can you help me just, you know, kind of have a steer? Maybe I'll apply to some hotels as well. So I literally wrote off to about, you know, 15, 20 different places. That was when you actually wrote a letter, which is kind of, you know, thing back in the day.
Yeah.
You wrote to people? Used a stamp? How does that work?
Quite charming.
Did all that. And basically, you know, a few wrote back. And I wish I had kept the letters, but I didn't. But, you know. And the majority said, look, you know, can't come and work here because you don't have enough qualifications. Sorry, you don't have enough work experience. Well, you know, and I put, you know, all this, that I'm hardworking and passionate and dedicated, and I can give everything to you and da, da, da. But that was like, okay, how am I supposed to get experience if I can't get any? It's like a bit of another conundrum. So I then said to my father, what about, you know, this sounds a bit stupid, but what about if I write again and I'll say that I'll work for nothing, for free? And he looked at me like, are you crazy? I was like, well, it's the only way that I'm going to actually show people that I am dedicated and, you know, maybe I'm a little reasonably bit gifted in what I want to do as a career. So he's like, okay, well, why not? Anyway, so I did that and then I got two responses. One was from David Cavalier and the other one was from one of the Rue brothers at the Gavroche. And they just said, look, you know, very sweet and quite a humble sort of letter. And, you know, we just can't let you because back then as well, all these restaurants, they actually had a waiting list, which is kind of hard to believe, for chefs to get in. So all of them had literally like a 2-3 year waiting list for people to come in. Wow. It was kind of crazy world back then. And then David popped up and said, look, yeah, come on in. I'll take you.
Yeah.
So then I went to work with David, and so I worked for free. I wasn't paid a penny. And after that, yeah, he gave me a job and said, look, you know, definitely think, you know, you've got something. And yeah, so I stayed with him for a year. And at that point, you know, I wanted to go and work, you know, with Pierre Kaufman after that, definitely. So he then helped me get an interview. Well, no, it wasn't really an interview. It lasted about 3 minutes and that was it. It was so funny.
Really?
Yeah, got an interview. And I went in, I was like, you know, absolutely petrified, as you can imagine. I was then only, whatever, like 20.
Yeah.
You know, wee thing of a lad. And there was this big, you know, brusque sort of French chef. And I was probably dressed in an oversized suit or something, as you would be back then. And going to meet him, and I'm like, you know, sitting in the reception area, and I've been told to wait, and my palms are like sweating, and I'm like, oh my God. Everyone's staring at me, who's this, like, you know, little boy coming in. And anyway, he comes in and shakes my hand and says, so you want a job? I said, yes, please. And basically said, yeah, you can come as a commis and yes, you can start in 2 weeks. Okay.
Done.
See you, bye.
That's great.
And that was it.
Have chefs got weaker now, do you think? I mean, is it harder to find people who actually really want to, you know, scrap their way to the top?
We're in a very different environment. We're in a very different place. And I think, you know, the objectives and goals are very different, I think, today. As, you know, as a young chef from when I was obviously starting, and, you know, I had a projection and I knew my path, you know, from the moment that I had step foot, you know, into college. And another story that, you know, that came around when I was at college, which I don't know if I told you or not, but it was another momentous occasion in my career, was that I think I was there for like 2 or 3 months, and the teacher that I'd had my interview with, he came up to me and he pulled me aside. He said, look, you know, just beware, I'm keeping an eye on you. And I said, what do you mean by that? It sounded a bit weird. And he said, well, you know, I'm just going to tell you this, but, you know, you're very lucky to be on this course. And I was like, well, what do you mean? He says, well, the only reason we took you was because you're a twin. And I was like, excuse me? He says, well, yeah, we weren't going to take you because you had a bad interview. And the only reason we did was, you know, because you're a twin and we didn't want to separate you. Sure. So I was like, thanks for the pep talk, mate. So I turned around to him as a cocky 16-year-old. I said, well, you know what? In 10 years' time, you're going to know who I am and I'm going to be famous.
Did you send him the newspaper cuttings? Have you been the youngest 2 minutes?
Well, I did. I mean, that, you know, kind of projected into, you know, as I said, where I went to, you know, the reason who I wanted to go and work with and the chefs that I went to work with. And for me, the most important thing was, like, how do I put myself to a degree on a pedestal amongst others, you know? And the only thing that I thought was, I need to work out of... Everyone needs to work out of their comfort zone. But, you know, working in London, to a degree you were already out of your comfort zone, but I meant to take it to another level, another sort of extreme environment. And that's why I wanted to go and work in France, because I knew no one was working abroad out of London or out of the UK. And I just thought, if I did that, then someone is going to notice little me.
Yeah. You know?
When you were at Pied de Terre in London, though, apparently it was one of the most brutal kitchens in the country. Can you just tell us how tough that was? Was that the toughest place you worked, do you think, in terms of...
Well, Robuchon was definitely the the toughest
in England.
On the hours, but on, you know, on working in Pied de Terre back in the day, yeah, it was pretty intense, yes, I would say.
Can you tell us a couple of little memories?
Well, I'm not gonna go into details, but I mean, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, it's not what you do, you know. But I mean, there were just definitely lots of instances where, you know, the intense pressure of what you were put under as a young boy, which I definitely say, you know, I mean, and I think anyone between 20 and 30, I know it shows how old I am when I say you're a young boy.
Yeah,
I think, you know, what Richard's, I would say, you know, in terms of management skills of people, you know, non-existent, that's for sure. But he was an amazing chef, an amazing cook, you know, that was where his talent shone. And I think, you know, back in those days, obviously HR didn't exist, and it was probably for a good reason, because there wouldn't be anyone in the kitchen working. So, you know, and I remember, you know, I had a lot of, you know, chefs that I was working with that, you know, come and went, and to a degree, you know, you kind of just got on with it because you didn't know any better. And in a way, it's quite, you know, it is, you know, when I think back, you know, it's quite to a degree sad, because I can't also, you know, it's quite, you know, hazy, a lot of it. I don't remember a lot of it. And in a way, it rubbed off on me in a bad way as well. You know, I was, you know, an obnoxious little shit bag as well. And I was, you know.
Do you regret it? I mean, obviously you became
head chef. I think, you know, when you're in that environment, you know, of intensity, and just in the way that you're spoken to, it's not an excuse, you know, in the way that you should behave as a human being, you know. But in a way, of course, you know, I kind of view it as a Clockwork Orange moment, you know, if you remember, in that film where he's got his eyes open and he's like seeing all these things happen, and he's turned into this, you know, monosyllabic monster. And in a way, you know, it was just kind of a crazy moment. And so I would say that, you know, although I'm very happy in terms of, you know, what I achieved, but apart from that, you know, it was all a bit of a blur.
It's always the same story which keeps on getting pulled off in like every paper. The fact, you know, that one evening when you ended up having to leave the restaurant, when you were head chef afterwards, right?
You've done your homework here.
Yeah,
but you were stoking the fire.
But you were always going to go and set up your own restaurant anyway, which obviously you got a Michelin star in the first year, which we're going to touch on shortly. But obviously there was that one night where you had an interaction with another chef, supposedly with like a knife and...
A palette knife,
a heated palette knife. Do you still remember that night? Is it like washed out in your mind?
I don't want to go into details because, you know, it's part of my, you know, part of my earlier career that I'm, you know, not too proud of as such, or, you know, have fond memories. But at the end of the day, you know, I learned a valuable life in lesson, and I was definitely taught a big lesson, you know, in terms of, as a person, in terms of what you should and shouldn't do. And, you know, and I had to deal with a lot from that in terms of the fallout, as did the other guy. But at the end of the day, you know, we're all human beings, and everyone should be treated fairly and respectfully and in their workplace, and particularly when they're, you know, when they're working for you, they're putting the hours, the effort, the time, and they come to learn in your place of work, which should be a safe haven, you know. And at the end of the day, you know, I messed up.
But the industry's changed so much now.
I mean, yeah, of course it has.
You're obviously working for so many people where things like that were just kind of happening, right?
I mean,
what I think is interesting, like, so I've never worked in that sort of thing, but place called the Dot Kitchen where I worked for a long time, we did like, I don't know, 100 covers a night, and it was a very, like, it was a sort of new wave, a very relaxed restaurant. But still, when you're in the middle of that service and something goes wrong, you just lose your shit. Like, yeah. It was a very peaceful, like, chill restaurant. So it is a hard one because it's like being a chef is like thousands of like tiny deadlines being pushed in your face all the time.
Yeah,
I know. On the one hand, I can kind of understand how it gets.
Yeah. You know, the maturity comes, and you know, and this is the whole point. You know, as I say, between your learning years as a chef, as soon as you finish that, you're a different person. You know, everything is on you in terms of managing your staff, managing your kitchen. You know, and to a degree, it's not that you never stop learning, but it's a different, you know, it's a whole another different element of you know, of you as a person. And I don't think that I had, you know, I definitely know that I didn't have the tools to be able to deal with that, because no one had said, you know, okay, this is what you do or whatever.
Did you have anyone around you as like a mentor at that time? Kind of,
because you get taught
to be a chef, but you don't get taught to be.
And I definitely couldn't deal with the, you know, with the stresses and the pressure all that well. And, you know, I definitely, you know, as I know, had some anger management issues, which, you know, which I dealt with, that's for sure. But I think, you know, it's, as I said, as a maturity and the way that you mature as a person, and I can see it, you know, through my career in terms of the 20s to 30s, the 30s to 40s, the 40s to 50s, etc. Just how, you know, how you view things in terms of, you know, everything that goes on and around your world. It's you know, it's very different.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should have a drink. We're going to now do the go-to drinks, where we're going to quickly ask you your sort of go-to cocktail and a couple of other things. So Ben is going to reveal something from his bag of mysteries. What do you have for us today?
Do you want something alcoholic or non-alcoholic?
Probably non-alcoholic. I don't even know what the time of day is in here. Do you know?
No, it's like Las Vegas.
Is it 3 in the morning? Or? Wow. I don't really know. Oh, good. What's that? So this is obviously from our wonderful friends at Delhi. What is it?
Oh, wow.
It's a wine alternative. It's not normally a good thing. But this is unbelievable.
That looks amazing.
So I'm going to crack it open.
Okay.
Freddie, crack it open.
Okay. Tom, we'll ask you, what is your go-to cocktail?
Whiskey sour.
Whiskey sour?
Yeah. When you go out to a place, you know, everyone has their sort of, okay, you know, signature drink or signature plate of food, and they go to a place and, you know, and they're hoping that it can be, you know, as good as they expect. And it's kind of your pinnacle drink or choice of food that marks the scale of a restaurant, you know, how good it is. And my thing is, you know, it's always a whiskey sour when I go to a place. It's just one of those classic cocktails that can be so amazingly beautiful, and it can go also horribly wrong.
Yeah. Cheers, Tom. Thanks for coming. Yes, have a taste of this. This is not wine alternative. Cheers, whole raspberries, chamomile, Murray River salt, organic cane sugar, and vigeur.
Smells very sweet on the when you first.
Oh yeah. I mean, you get the chamomile. You can get the salt.
Yeah, sort of taking you back to your days in the fields.
Right, Tom. Yeah. Somehow, Freddie and I are coming around for dinner at yours.
Yeah.
You're serving, giving us a whiskey sour.
Yeah.
What are you putting out with it? Are we getting some little snacks, some canapés? What's your go-to kind of...
I am, when I'm cooking at home, I'm a kind of, you know, simple man. No frills, no spills. And for me, I mean, you'll probably laugh at this, but you cannot be a good cheese straw.
Yeah, nice.
I agree.
Yeah.
Are you making it for us?
Yeah. So nice, you know... Dashed in plenty of Worcestershire sauce and Tabasco, black pepper, you know, definitely a nice mature aged Montgomery cheddar, bit of, you know, Parmesan and Gruyere, and
delicious.
Paprika, cayenne.
Delicious. Do you have a hangover, hangover drink of choice?
Bloody Mary, probably.
Yeah.
Again, nice and spicy and lots of flavour, celery salt, celery, maybe a bit of chilli chucked in there as well, and, you know.
That's great. Food-wise?
Roast chicken, man.
So many Michelin star places you've had, and so many incredible kitchens you've worked in. But what's the single greatest dish you've ever come up with?
I do remember some dishes that I did at Pied à Terre. When I was working with Pierre Coffman, he can't do it anymore because of Brexit and all of that. But we used to get the whole foie gras ducks that would come straight from Gascony. And we would get these ducks, and then you'd have the beautiful foie gras inside. And so we'd have everything there that you could use, the duck fat, the legs, the necks, obviously the foie gras. So when I started at Pied à Terre, I used to also, you know, get the ducks in, and they're just beautiful product. And so I always used to have this excess amount of duck confit. And I was like, oh my God, I've got so much duck confit. What am I going to do with it? Because at least with, you know, when I was working with Pierre, he would like stick it, you know, on everything. And he was doing, you know, more covers than me. So we would just, you know, use it all up. Anyway, so I always used to get this build-up of duck confit, and I came up with this dish, basically a ballantine of duck confit and foie gras, where I would, you know, I would basically, you know, have the duck confit, break it down, flavor it with some, you know, shallots and parsley and garlic and thyme and a bit of balsamic vinegar, da, da, da. And then I'd lay that out into a sheet. I would then cut in long cubes of foie gras along this, and I encase the foie gras in that, roll it up into a little ballantine of like this.
Mm.
And then in that same fat that I had cooked the confit, I'd then confit potato, little wrapped potatoes. And then those wrapped potatoes would be, once they're cooked, they'd be sliced up, sauteed, and I cut these ballantine, they'd be seared on both sides, finished in the oven, so the confit would be on the outside, would just be melting as with the foie gras, and then you'd have the crispy potatoes underneath, and then you'd have a mashed salad around the edge with a truffle vinaigrette.
That sounds absolutely incredible.
It was, yeah, that was kind of delicious.
What's your guilty pleasure? Because we're about to have some food, which is Ben's creator, but what is your guilty pleasure? And then we're going to go into your locations.
Could be anything from, you know, a plain bowl of vanilla ice cream.
Mm.
And whenever my kids are hilarious, like, Daddy, why are you just having vanilla ice cream? It's so boring. But I just love the pure essence. The reason is, again, because it takes me back to when I was working with Joel Robuchon. And on the Friday night when we used to do the deep clean, I would then, with one of the senior chef de parties, we would have the task of cleaning 5 floors of spiral staircase that used to go all the way down by,
oh my God,
by hand, literally ballet brush. So I would brush, he would mop, brush and mop. This would take about 2 hours to do, or an hour and a half. Anyway, the great thing that we would do is that because we started right on the top, it was the pastry section, and because at that point all the desserts had finished and the ice cream trolley was up there, and I remember just the flavor and eating this insane vanilla ice cream that obviously that they made, and I mean it was almost black with the amount of vanilla seeds that were in there, and that is why I'd always had such a go for with vanilla ice cream, because his was just
next level.
I mean, more than next level. It was just like, it just tasted of a vanilla bean. It was just amazing. That's why I just always have a...
Well, Ben, have you created some vanilla? What have you got?
I haven't created vanilla ice cream.
What have you got?
You put that. I've done a little ditch, so I should have put
that.
I've done
that.
A little muhammara.
Lovely.
Muhammara.
Muhammara. Your pronunciation is much better than mine.
Well, because I actually make it. I like it. I like.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
Come on.
Yeah,
I sort of made it because...
It's nice.
The soffles.
I find these delicious.
Oh, yeah, wow. Which you can get on GoTo. Which you can get on Deli, which are unbelievable. Yeah, the soffles delicious. Are great. You once said they were like, you know, run by a sort of a gang because they're so hard to find nowadays, but you can get them on Deli and they're amazing.
And then I've done a little, I thought something like sort of clean and nice, just a small bowl of some little Hainanese
already,
chicken. Hainanese chicken and rice.
Mm. Using products from Deli, I'm guessing.
Yeah, using products from Deli.
Looks amazing.
Did you make this?
Yeah. Is it all right?
Wow, man. Nicely seasoned.
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
You wait till you taste this little broth.
Ooh.
God, that broth looks amazing.
Didn't know I was getting fed today as well.
Yeah, you just said, well, it's lunchtime. You know, we'll give you a bit of lunch. Why not? As we do give you lunch, let's ask, what is your go-to spice or ingredient?
Okay, that's a difficult. Well, no, it's not. I let me know. Again.
Frederick?
I would probably say... It's quite a strong spice, but you can't always get it. Mace.
Oh, mace, yeah.
Yeah, because it's just like, you know, you can use it in lots of things and curries. You can use it in, you know, cake making as well. And I just, you know.
Am I right in thinking it's like the outside of the nutmeg?
It's the husk, it's the husk casing of the nutmeg.
A lot of places, like supermarkets, don't bother.
No, they don't, no. No, because I don't think a lot of people know what to do with it.
No.
And you can use it in pickles and everything. And I just think it's a lovely, underrated use of a, you know, skin of a nut.
What are you eating at family meal?
We all take it in turns. And sometimes we pick a country.
Nice.
And we derive the staff food from that. Or if it's, you know, because we have definitely, a multicultural amount of people in the kitchen, which is great, you know. So... Sometimes the lads cook up something that, you know, is from their country or whatever, and yeah.
So it could be anything.
Could be anything, yeah. So it's a nice way to do it. The Italian guys always do their risotto.
Yeah.
And it's always a damn good one.
I bet it is. So yeah. It has to be, right?
So, you know, it's a good way of doing it, you know. And then it also gives, you know, the other members of staff something that they probably wouldn't have eaten before either.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a good way to do it.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
What about a meal deal combination?
A meal combo?
A meal deal combination. Have you ever had a meal deal from a supermarket? Sandwich, crisp, and a fizz?
No, but I would always go for a cheese plowman's.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have vivid memories as well of, you know, long gone years ago of when I would, you know, on school trips and things.
Mm.
And my mother would have packed up my packed lunch. And I remember, and this is a bit weird. So any sandwich, like I used to love cheese and tomato or, you know, ham, cheese and pickle. I would let them sweat in purpose in the cling film and put them like in the sunshine.
What is that? So that to get the cheese like up to temperature, or just so that just like everything kind of amalgamates?
Yeah, yeah, I just kind of like the sweaty taste of it.
Really?
Bit weird.
No, that's not a memory that has made it onto your menu yet.
No.
Yeah, sweaty sandwich.
Sweaty sandwich.
Sweaty sandwich. Yeah. Deal with it.
No, it's good.
Should we go locations?
Let's go locations.
What's your go-to weeknight restaurant? If obviously you're not working at your wonderful Michelin star place, where are you going?
I've just been recently to Dorian.
Mm. Mm.
I've been twice in the last month.
Well,
because I couldn't believe how good it was, and it was very, very good.
Shout out, Matt.
And you know, it was amazing, and really, you know, again, it's all about, you know, talent of the chef and the raw product. It was very good. So generally, I don't go on a Monday, because Monday as well is the only time that I get to spend, you know, my kiddies.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, I've got the weekend, but I like a weeknight. It's the only night that I have with them. So I tend to, you know, be at home with them.
Where are you going for a blowout celebratory special supper?
You know, we're very, very blessed with the amount of insane good quality restaurants that we have now in this capital. I think, you know, when you look at the price range of what you had from, you know, £15 up to obviously blowout, whatever, 300-400, whatever you want to spend, you know, on sushi, you know, we are truly blessed. The amount of amazing talented chefs. And I have my, you know, I guess some ones that, you know, that are local to me, or ones that, you know, I'm friends with, that I will probably choose.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm never going to say, oh, that's my firm favourite.
No,
because,
but come on,
you know,
let's be a bit brutal.
So listen, I mean, out of chefs that I've eaten food recently, you know, I've been to Claude's, Bibendum and the Peninsula, been to Tom Sellers, you know, so it just, you know, again, depends on the moment and if I've got, you know,
yeah,
the time.
We are spoiled. We're spoiled.
Yeah, we basically. Are. Yeah, we are. I don't think there is. Well, there are a couple of capitals in the world that, you know, they're on par with us. But I just think, in terms of the variety, because of our cultural heritage and history and diversity of what we have in the capital, you know, we're lucky.
Yeah, bang on.
What about your favorite hidden gem?
If I can think back, like a few years ago, when they had just started Chicken Sours.
Yeah,
when I went the first last week. Time.
It's good, isn't it?
That pickled watermelon is unbelievable.
Yeah. And
that's a nice shout, Tom. I like that.
When I went the first time, I was like, fucking hell, this is...
I agree with you. I told them to change their name so people, like, you know, they could call it like a Thai kooky like restaurant name, and people would be like, this is insane.
Yeah.
You wouldn't expect Chicken Sears.
Yeah, right.
He was quite insulted by that. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
you were kicked out.
Yeah, he kicked me out and then beat me up. But it's
amazing.
Good.
Like, everything's very high, like delicious. Yeah,
yeah, it is. Yeah. And that's, for me, that is the most important thing. Right? Like, regardless of, you know, of price that you're paying, whether it's a 3-star meal or it's a, you know, or it's a fast food takeaway, the food has to be tasty and delicious. Yeah. And then some of these places, particularly, I would, you know, say when you're going to 2 or 3-star, they forget that, you know, and they're trying to do something else, you know. But at the end of the day, if you are paying a shitload of money, you want it to be tasty and delicious, you know, and you want it to be seasonally driven. And it's not about, you know, what the chef is wanting to do, you know. It just has to be that. Sometimes
that should be
that.
The starting point, yeah, because fundamentally it is still you're cooking someone's lunch or supper.
Yeah, exactly. Totally.
Should we go to the deli bag?
Yeah, can you remember what's in there, Tom?
We got some tuna, we got some anchovy, we got some coconut milk, we got curry paste of sometimes, and a bag of noodles.
Wow, you got a great memory.
What are you thinking? I mean, like, it's hard when you give
them
a laxer paste.
And guys, you can make the same thing. Are we going to do?
Well, listen, I mean, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a curry of something. We've got the noodles and we've got the, you know, the anchovy and the tuna. So I probably, if I had a little bit of...
You can bring some other things.
Okay, well, I have some, obviously, some from some fresh chili, some olive oil, some garlic, and I would then fry the shit out of, obviously, the chili and the garlic and everything with some dry chili flakes. Literally have the ramen noodles just, you know, ready to go,
yeah.
Cooked. Chuck in the anchovy and the tuna chunks, just literally like 15 seconds, just quickly fry them in that chili and garlic, chuck on the noodles, and have the coconut milk and the turmeric and lemongrass thing simmering kind of away, and then chuck it all together.
Yeah, that is incredible. Done. And guys, you can do the same. All you do is go to the Deli website, put in the code GOTODELI, and you can get 25% off. Tom, you've been absolutely wonderful. Mission stars galore. Incredible pleasure. Memories, highs and lows. Just a wonderful career. But everyone go check out his amazing restaurant, if you can get space. We obviously can't at the moment. We're going to finish off with your go-to three-course meal. If you could eat one three-course meal one more time,
okay,
what would it be?
So, starter would be scallops in the half shell, just with olive oil, butter, garlic, thyme, lemon zest, cooked on a barbie, bubble, 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 caramelization, cooked a little bit of garlic in there. Then it would be a beautiful aged ribeye of beef, coming from an old dairy cow, probably around, you know, 8-9 years, being hanging for about 6 weeks, triple cooked, chipped in beef fat, homemade, of course, hollandaise or béarnaise sauce, on the side, and then vanilla ice cream with a tart tatin.
Good. Well, Tom, you've been absolutely wonderful. Good luck with everything, and thank you so much for coming in and telling us your amazing story. We could have stayed for hours more and enjoyed this wonderful non-alcoholic wine and obviously the wonderful food you've created, Ben. But guys, we'll be back again next week. Please leave us a 5-stars rating, share it with all your friends, and a couple of comments, and just, you know, share the love, because it really helps us. Tom, those are your go-tos. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tom.